From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start this hour in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where police have arrested a man in connection with the killing of four Muslim men. 51-year-old Mohammed Sayed is charged with the two most recent murders, and police say he is a suspect in the two others. Sayed has lived in New Mexico for several years after immigrating from Afghanistan. The New York Times is reporting that police say they are aware of reports that he may have targeted at least two of the men because he was angry that his daughter married a man from a different branch of Islam than the family practices. Police have not yet formally assigned a motive. We have response to the arrest from family member Mohammed Imtiaz Hussain. His brother, Mohammed Afzal Hussain, had moved from Pakistan to New Mexico to attend college. He was working in city planning. He was just 27 when he was shot and killed on August 1st. Imtiaz Hussain, what a terrible shock, a week of shocks. We're so sorry.
Thank you so much, Robin, for having me. Yeah. Indeed, it was a big shock, not only for me personally and my family. Whole community was in shock because there's something organized going on against Muslim community here, our immigrant community. So people suffered. People didn't go out from their houses. They didn't go for work. But thanks a lot, when the suspect got arrested, the fear that this is something organized or politically motivated or based on religion, that fear is reduced. So now people are going to normal routine of life.
Well, you say thanks God someone was arrested because you now don't have to fear that it's an organized, you know, maybe political attack on your community. But your thoughts on the fact that it's someone from within the community?
That man who was arrested yesterday, that guy, I met him a couple of times in Islamic Center. I remember last time when I attended an Eid festival, I know that he was from Afghanistan. Now, what is the motive under which he killed my brother and other people? We are still waiting from FBI and Albuquerque Police Department to tell us if he shot my brother or other people because of his daughter. My brother is single, and how many daughters he has?
And by the way, Ahmad Asaid, who's president of the Islamic Center of New Mexico, the mosque there, said authorities told him that it was a Sunni Muslim who was enraged about his daughter marrying a Shia. In this tight community, just, you know, a few thousand Muslims in Albuquerque, but it's a city of, you know, maybe 500,000.
It's very complicated so far. We do not brand ourselves with any sect of Islam, but we are raised as Sunni.
So you're saying that if this had been the motive, and please say it may be, it was even incorrect. Your brother and another victim were Sunni, not Shia.
At least we are Sunni. We are Muslims. We do not carry any sectarian brand with our names, nor in our orientation.
And I'm understanding that this kind of sectarian divide is the kind of thing that many of you who have immigrated to the United States had hoped to leave behind in home countries where it was so violent.
The speculation that all these four killings are based off their religious sect, I do not believe. This is just speculation. We have left any type of identity, even home, in Pakistan.
Tell me about your brother.
My brother, he was a leader, born leader, I will say. When he came to University of New Mexico as grad student, he was elected as president of Graduate Student Union here in University of New Mexico. And he was so happy, he told me that he contested election, being new here, defeated a woman, Hispanic woman, native New Mexican, and he said, look, I got 74% of votes and my opponent is only 26%. Look, I'm immigrant. I'm Muslim. I'm dark skin. English is not my first language. And even look, people appreciated me.
Yeah,
there's no discrimination in this land.
Look, I got elected, you know, head of the graduate student organization. I mean,
yes.
He sounded so proud, and you must have been so proud, and I'm so sorry.
Yeah, and then he went to manage a campaign of Manly Stansbury, who's congresswoman here in District 1, state of New Mexico. He was her campaign organizer. And Manly Stansbury won election. He was so happy.
Yeah. Mohammed Imtiaz Hussain, his brother Mohammed Afzal Hussain, one of four Muslim men murdered in Albuquerque. A man has been charged in two of the deaths and is a suspect in two others. Imtiaz Hussein, we are so sorry.
Thank you so much.
In Ukraine, attacks on Europe's largest nuclear power plant have raised fears of catastrophic consequences. Russia took control of the Zaporizhia power plant in March, but Ukrainians still work there. Today, G7 leaders have called on Russia to return the plant to Ukraine after rocket attacks this weekend. The Washington Post's John Hudson joins us live to talk about it from Lviv. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be with you.
So strikes around a nuclear power plant are obviously dangerous. Tell us more about the risks posed by the fighting there right now.
There are a huge number of risks, according to experts, a lot of different things that they're worried about. The main thing being that, you know, this is people have called this and referred to this nuclear plant, the largest in Europe, as sort of Russia's Ukrainian fortress. But the reality is that nuclear plants are not actually a fortress, and they're not actually designed to take external rocket fire, external artillery fire, and that's what poses such a risk. And so there's two really most the two gravest risks that experts have mentioned is one, just power being cut off to the plant. You know, the nuclear plant needs power so that it can be cooled. And, you know, that poses a huge risk. The other one is that there has been fighting near the storage of spent fuel. And that is outside sort of the most fortified part of the plant. And so when you have rocket fire around there, which there already has been, that has the risk of causing a huge nuclear catastrophe as well.
What do we know about where the attacks themselves have come from and how much they have damaged the plant? I mean, Russia and Ukraine have traded blame for this.
They have. It's made it very difficult, and both the Russians and the Ukrainians have assigned blame. Both of them have accused each other of using rockets. That's the one sort of area where they sort of agree. But that is why there has been such a strong and urgent call for international inspectors to come over there and get a grip on what actually is happening over there. This is obviously a hotly contested military. This is a hotly contested military environment, and so there is a desire to have UN experts go in. And but they also have to hammer out those details.
Yeah.
And because you're involving warring parties, they can't agree on the manner in which UN officials would enter. Would they come in through Kyiv and then go visit the site from there? Or would they come in from Russian-occupied Crimea? Those have very delicate political implications with the Ukrainians opposing the idea that any international body would enter Ukraine from Russian-occupied Crimea.
And what is
that's a red line for them.
And what does Russia want to do with the plant moving forward?
So U.S. officials, at least, accuse Russia of using the plant as a sort of shield. They are lobbing fire into Ukraine from the plant. But beyond that, Ukrainian officials say that the ultimate plan for the Russians is to actually use that use the plant, cut it off from Ukraine, and use it to energize and provide power to the Russian-occupied parts of Ukraine. That would obviously pose a big problem for the large parts of Ukraine that are powered by that plant. So that's another big concern that both Ukrainians and Western officials have.
You spoke with an expert who said that this is the first time a major nuclear power plant has been in the middle of an active war zone. And Ukraine's state nuclear power agency said this weekend that, quote, nuclear catastrophe was miraculously avoided, but miracles cannot last forever. Is there a way to get out of this safely at this point?
The recommended method is to get those inspectors there as soon as possible. And the reason why people are pushing so hard for that is that once you get an environment where you have the International Atomic Energy Agency there, UN officials there, it then becomes a sort of overly toxic burden for either the Ukrainians or the Russians to fire into that area. And so it would bring some sense of control and some sense of stability there instead of the absolute chaos that we're seeing right now and the rocket fire and artillery fire that's going on at the moment.
About 15 seconds, John. I want to turn to Crimea briefly. What's the latest on that mysterious explosion at a Russian airbase? Russia says it was an accident. No response from Ukraine. What's going on? Quickly.
Yeah, well, earlier today, a Ukrainian official confirmed to my Washington Post colleagues that explosion was the result of Ukrainian special forces. It's a dramatic change. Publicly, the Ukrainians are putting out statements saying that you shouldn't be smoking near explosives, a sort of joke on the Russians. But it's a big moment for the Ukrainians, probably the most satisfied they've been since the downing of the Russian warship in April.
John Hudson from The Washington Post, thanks. Today, kids across the nation are returning to the classroom for the first day of school, but some teens are dreading going back. Many college-bound kids are stressed, anxious, and navigating new and complicated demands. They feel like achievement-oriented performance machines climbing the next tier of a relentless ladder to quote-unquote success. But at what cost? Bell Liang and Tim Klein have devoted their careers to helping students find their purpose. Bell is a licensed clinical psychologist and professor of counseling at Boston College. She founded the Purpose Lab at BC to advance the science and practice of cultivating purpose in schools and workplaces. Tim Klein is an urban educator, clinical therapist, and school counselor. Their new book is How to Navigate Life: The New Science of Finding Your Way in School, Career, and Beyond. Bell and Tim, welcome to Here and Now.
So wonderful to be here. Thank you, Jane.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Bell, I'll start with you. You work with students all the time who have what you call the performance mindset. Young people who are trying to find the fastest route to success, achievement at all costs. How do you see students suffering today? And what's the downside of this performance mindset?
Well, I see that they come into school with the same mindset that got them there. It's to do, to perform, to chase success. And it's really not the success itself that's hurting them. It's the obsession to achieve it. Because when they're piling up all these successes to try to prove themselves, to try to save themselves, it's their only goal, they're driven by overwhelming fear and anxiety to achieve it. And this is why the research shows that students with this mindset have all sorts of negative mental health and physical health outcomes also. It's a very sad and terrible irony that this obsession with chasing success and the stress of chasing it actually compromises their performance in the end too.
Mm. And on the other end of the spectrum is what you identify in the book as the passion mindset. Just do what makes you happy, you know, follow your bliss. Tim, what are the problems with that opposite mindset, the passion mindset?
I think the problem with that is when we put happiness as the center of what's most important in life, the research is very, very clear that it actually makes us more depressed, more anxious. It hurts our relationships with other people because it sends this very dangerous message that negative emotions are to be avoided at all costs. And when we only do things that we feel like we want to do, it can make us not do big, challenging, courageous goals that feel important.
So the performance mindset is this race toward achievement and success. The passion mindset says just do what makes you happy. Your research has shown that the sweet spot is actually what you call the purpose mindset. Bell, make the case for a purpose mindset. Why do we need it? Why is it important?
The other two mindsets are very focused on me. It's about proving yourself. It's about worrying about yourself. It's chasing after these extrinsic measures of success like wealth, power, prestige, just for the sake of measuring up to others. But purpose is different in that it turns your focus outward to the needs in the world around you. So whether it's your family or a societal problem that you're passionate about tackling, it gives you a reason to get up in the morning. It's not because you're terrified anymore that you'll be successful enough, but because you're excited about the impact you want to make. And the research is very clear that when young people, even from the most impoverished, marginalized communities, all the way to the most affluent, high-achieving communities, when they have a purpose mindset, they're more engaged in school. They're less affected by academic and life stress, so they're more resilient. And they're more likely to be thriving then in their careers and in their lives.
Tim, for years you've worked in high schools and dramatically increased college matriculation for even the most disadvantaged students. How did you help disengaged kids latch on to this purpose mindset?
Students need space to be able to know what is personally meaningful to them and what contribution they want to make. And just an example, I was working with this one student, Marcus, who was academically disengaged. He was on the verge of dropping out. He comes into my office and I just ask him, what do you want to do after high school if you could do anything? And his answer, like a lot of young men, was be a YouTuber. Well, why do you want to be a YouTuber? And his answer was really astounding because he talked about how he had been bullied when he was in middle school. And the only thing that got him through that was connecting with a YouTuber who had also talked about bullying, who made him feel not alone. And so that led to a conversation about how could he use education, whether he was learning editing, design, video production, to achieve that purpose that he had talked about just through that one question I asked him.
But what about the people who are listening who may be thinking, I'd love to have a purpose mindset, but I don't have the luxury of that. I'm just working to survive, need to pay my bills, to put food on the table. What do you say to those folks, Belle?
I think that, you know, there's this misconception that you could only have one or the other. You can either be purposeful or take the practical route. And the reality from our research is that we see that young people who have a purpose mindset, is no matter how disadvantaged they are, that drives them to get up in the morning. It gives them a reason for living. And ultimately, it helps them to be more engaged in school and more successful at doing it. So this isn't about sacrificing a paycheck. And, you know, students need an opportunity to explore what really matters to them. And then there are ways to really consider the practical concerns that they have around financial security.
You say in the book that purpose is a completely translatable quality in every aspect of life, not just for students, but from first jobs to last jobs and everywhere in between. Tim, how so?
Yeah, I think there's this myth about purpose that it's kind of like a true love, that there's just one purpose out there and your goal is to find it. And the research is actually very clear that purpose is cultivated over time. It's actually practiced on a daily basis. So any moments in our lives where we're doing things that are personally meaningful, where we're using our strengths or gaining new skills, or we feel like we're contributing to the world, whether it's holding a door open for someone or trying to like make big societal changes, those are all elements of purpose. And so purpose, it's really not about what we're doing specifically, but it's about the intention and the meaning we put into why we are pursuing the goals that we are.
Belle, you and Tim have an interesting partnership. You write about growing up in a performance mindset, you personally. You're the daughter of first-generation Chinese immigrants who had high expectations for you. And Tim, you grew up with a passion mindset. You write being raised by quintessential hippie parents. They didn't push you. They just told you to kind of go follow your bliss. And you write about how these opposing mindsets landed you in very empty places. How did you each find your way to what you call the purpose mindset?
I had for my whole life believed in the education meritocracy, that if you work hard, you're going to be able to achieve anything. And so I did everything in my power to make good on my parents' sacrifices, bringing us to the U.S. so that we could have an education. And I ended up exhausted and confused because so much of what I was doing felt like I was living somebody else's life and not my own. There were some pivotal points in my journey, including during the end of my college years and during my early career, where I realized that, you know, I would be far more able to pursue my purpose if I just started listening more closely to my own heart and not just trying to live somebody else's life.
Tim?
Yeah, when my passion ran out, I started asking myself big questions, my parents did too, of how do you want to be remembered? How do you want to grow as a person? What do you want to stand for? And it was actually being able to ask these really, really big questions and seeking answer is where I found Belle and I found purpose and I found all the work. And I think the reason we wrote this book, it's all about asking students big questions and giving them the tools they need to explore it. But we've never taught parents how to have these conversations with their students.
Well, you both have skin in the game. You've got kids of your own. Tim, you have little kids, but Belle, you've got one just out of college and one soon headed to college. I've got one headed to college next week. As purpose researchers, what do you tell your own kids?
What I tell my own kids is that time always feels like it's running out, you know, even when you're 18. It feels like we have a very short time to make our mark in the world, and I think that drives a lot of anxiety. And so we look outside ourselves to try to fill that need of making our mark. But actually, everything we have, everything we need is right within us. You know, we know what we're intrinsically motivated to do. We have within us passions and interests and strengths that we delight in. And so much of the journey is about turning inward rather than looking outside to gain some goal that may never be achievable. We have right within us exactly what we need.
Tim, I'll give you the last word.
Yeah, I think in really writing this book and doing the research on purpose as a parent, it's made me realize that my kids who are 5.5 and 3 already have a sense of purpose. They're innately curious about the world. And really, I see my goal as sparking that purpose wherever it may lead them. So I've really let go of trying to figure out, make sure that they're on some clear path to some sort of future destination, and just really seeing them for who they are, the strengths that they bring, the skills that they're bringing. And it's allowed me to be way more present, way more engaged, and just to have a lot more fun in the parenting. And that's really what we're trying, a message we're trying to give to all parents and educators in writing this book.
Belle Liang is a clinical psychologist and professor of counseling at Boston College. Tim Klein is a clinical therapist and school counselor. Their new book is How to Navigate Life, The New Science of Finding Your Way in School, Career, and Beyond. It's inspiring to hear people whose purpose is to help others find their purpose, so thank you.
Thank you so much, Jane. This was wonderful.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you, Jane.
Inflation is easing just a little bit. That's the takeaway from today's Consumer Price Index report. In July, inflation was up 8.5% over last year, but that's slower than the 9.1% annual increase in June, which was a 40-year high. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jane.
So this easing inflation has a lot to do with falling gas prices. Tell us what's happening here and why.
Yeah, it's mostly actually falling energy prices in general. Inflation, as you said, largely flat from the month before, but there's been a major drop off in gasoline prices. There's an offset, and that is that food and shelter prices are actually higher. So when you look at the gas prices, there are three things at play as to why we are paying less for it right now. One is that the high costs of gas do actually weaken demand. There are people who just make choices about the fact that they don't have the budget, they can't deal with the added price of it, so they drive less. The other matter is that the price of oil internationally has also gone down, so that's brought the prices down. And a number of states have suspended gasoline taxes sort of as an emergency move to try and make gas prices a little more affordable. So most of what you're seeing in the fact that inflation is flat is because of a big decrease in energy prices. But the fact that it's largely flat means that something else is up if energy prices are that far down, and that something are the other two things that you need to live on, and that is food and shelter.
Right. You mentioned grocery prices up in July more than 13% compared to last year, Ali. I mean, gosh, so many people are feeling this. Why are these food prices still so high?
So there are a few issues at play here. One is we've still got some supply chain issues. There have been some poor harvests on account of weather around the world. There's a shortage of food largely from Ukraine. We've just started seeing ships this week starting under Russian escort to allow some of the grain and other products that come out of Ukraine to do so. There's also, believe it or not, a shortage of fertilizer connected to Ukraine. So all of these things together are causing higher prices for food. It's not across the board, but what it's meaning is that because there are higher prices for dairy, for fruit, for vegetables, for baked goods, and for meat, people are trying to substitute in buying other things, and that's causing the price of certain other things that are not in short supply to go up. So that's a bit of a mess, because for people on a fixed income, first they were hit by higher gasoline prices, and now I mean, that's really hard to do. To change your eating habits around is harder than changing your transportation habits.
Yeah, sure is. So give us the big picture here, Allie. What should we make of today's report? Do you see any hints that price increases on things that we're buying every day, maybe turning around here?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Fed has been relatively aggressive. A lot of people will say they were late to the game in raising interest rates, but they've been fairly aggressive to try and contain inflation. Some of it's limited. I mean, you can't raise interest rates to get people to, you know, reduce their demand for food. That it doesn't work on things like that. So it's a delicate balance. If the Fed is too forceful to try and slow the economy down, that could actually trigger a recession. We're not in one right now. There's some people who think we are, but probably we're not. And that has unwanted consequences. The one good thing, Jane, is we're still seeing wages increase and we're still seeing job numbers, jobs being created. So for the moment, it's wait and see till next month.
Yep. Fed meets next month to decide whether to raise interest rates again. We'll be watching. Allie Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. As always, Allie, thanks.
Thanks, Jane.
So, what's up with insulin? You know, people with diabetes need it to stay alive, but in recent years, we've brought you so many stories of young people in particular rationing their insulin because they can't afford it. There was much hue and cry, and the Democrats included a cap on insulin costs, $35 a month, in their recent Inflation Reduction Act, but Republican lawmakers deep-sixed that. The bill, which the House is expected to pass this week, does limit how much people on Medicare have to pay out of pocket for that life-saving medication. But again, no cap for people with private insurance or no insurance. Dr. Jing Luo is an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. He joins us now. And Dr., we spoke to you back in December. People are finding that story, explaining why insulin does cost so much. And at that time, you were excited for this insulin provision, this cap. What do you think of what ended up happening?
Well, thanks for having me back. It's still, I think it's a huge step forward for the 3.3 million Medicare beneficiaries who use insulin today. But it's a little bit, I guess, disheartening to find out that that copay cap does not apply to people with commercial insurance or the uninsured, because we're still talking about tens of millions of people.
Well, let's get right to it. Do you think, as some Republicans did, that if, in fact, there was a cap, a broader cap, the companies would simply raise premiums?
I think that's a possibility, yeah.
Well, but then that was the thinking of some of those who were against this. Are you saying they might have had a point, that a cap might not have meant anything if the companies could just get their money out of the premiums?
Well, I mean, you can make that argument for any healthcare service.
Yeah.
Why do we pay for maternity services and deliveries? There are people who are against that because they think that men shouldn't have to pay for women to deliver babies. You know, and I think we've moved past that as a society, and we figured that that's probably a legitimate service to pay for using health insurance.
Yeah.
And I think that's where this idea about covering insulin at an affordable rate should be. Do we as a society think that people who use insulin for treatment of their diabetes should be able to afford it, such that it's a covered service that we all pay for using premiums, or do we think it's excluded?
Yeah.
And I think that's the debate that's going on right now.
Well, and I should, full disclosure, some of us are not just you who work in this field, but me, who lives with a diabetic, just a full disclosure. But explain for people who are trying to grasp this, why do diabetics need insulin? This isn't just, I mean, aspirin can be life-saving, but this is different. Why?
Sure. So I think it's like 1 in 10 Americans live with diabetes. And if you look in the Medicare population, those are the slightly older population, it's about 1 in 3. And so it's pretty common. Most of us have a family member or friend who has diabetes. Some of these patients will be fine without insulin because they have other glucose-lowering medications that they can use. But there's a smaller subset of patients, including most notably patients with type 1 diabetes whose pancreases don't make any insulin, which means that they require this hormone for survival. For them, it's like water or air. If they didn't have insulin for a few days, you know, they could go into a diabetic coma and die.
Yeah, they'd die. And this isn't a lifestyle choice. This isn't just eat better. This isn't, as you said, just to reinforce, for many diabetics, there just is no production of insulin from the pancreas. So Why is it so expensive? Because we also know the history of insulin, created by wonderful Canadian researchers who won the Nobel Prize for discovering insulin, but then also sold it for $3. You know, they wanted to give it away. They didn't want it to be a money-making possibility. Why is it so expensive now?
Oh, well, so insulin today is largely made by only three large manufacturers. Those are Eli Lilly, Sanofi, and Novo Nordisk. What's been happening in recent years is that they've been increasing their list prices in lockstep with one another. And so without pretty robust generic competition or any form of hard price controls at the federal level, we've seen that the manufacturers have been able to just increase their prices as much as the market will bear.
And do you think, as somebody who observes this so closely, I mean, there's also the argument, and you explained that it's also very difficult to make insulin. It has to be perfectly manufactured. Is this purely, in your view, to make money, that they're raising the prices?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. These are publicly traded companies that have to answer to shareholders who are demanding profits, you know, every quarter. If they were all of a sudden to just say, oh, we're gonna cut our prices by 90%, you know, closer to the cost of production, I don't think their shareholders would be really happy about that. Yeah. And so I think that's part of why we see that happening. And then the other is related to what you've been describing, which is this idea that insulin is a biologic product. It's made in living organisms, and it's something we inject into our skins and into our bodies. And so it needs to be pure, it needs to be free from any contaminants, and we have to make sure that people don't get infections.
Yeah. We've had stories, as I mentioned, young people who've died and their parents discovered that, you know, they were maybe away at school and couldn't afford their insulin. The costs, we hear, are sometimes $1,000 a month. Can you explain, first of all, why it might get that high? People think, oh, you just get one order of insulin and you're done. Why might it get up to $1,000 a month?
Yeah, that's because the list prices of these products are so high in the U.S. And so if you don't have insurance, let's say you're a younger person and you work for an employer who doesn't provide prescription drug coverage, or you're in between jobs. That's pretty common, too. You know, nowadays, a lot of people are quitting because of the pandemic and getting new jobs. They might be without insurance for a certain part of the year. And for someone with type 1 diabetes who requires insulin every single day, if they don't have the stockpiles to last them until the next employer-sponsored health insurance, which is the predominant way we get insurance in this country, or through Medicaid, for example, they would essentially be having to buy insulin at the list price. And the list price is grossly unaffordable for the vast majority of Americans. And so for some products, we're talking about an excess of $1,000 per vial or for a box of 5 pens.
And people have died.
Yeah. There have been several cases reported of people rationing their insulin because of cost or insurance-related reasons. And that's in large part to why we see so many of these bills that have passed through state legislatures and now through the Congress that is trying to cap out-of-pocket costs for insulin, even for the uninsured. Unfortunately, that didn't really make it into the right version of the bill that was passed by the Senate.
Well, do you think there's another way for those who want to see these prices stabilized, you know, to limit what, I mean, you just described as price gouging now that the bill is moving forward? Is there something else? Could there be an executive action? What else could there be?
Yeah, I mean, there could be a standalone bill looking at insulin out-of-pocket costs. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to go through this budget reconciliation process lumped together with this climate bill that could potentially pass one day. And then the states could also pass legislation on their own, irrespective of what the federal government does. And then in the longer term, you know, we're talking more like, what can we do in terms of using the existing system to lower prices more durably? And then we're thinking more about like trying to get generic competitors and manufacturers to come in and make more less expensive insulin.
Well, there is a generic coming, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's been announced, but we'll have to see if it happens. There is a company called Civica that has announced that they will start producing three of the most common insulin products used in the U.S. as early as, 2024.
You know, I asked you for the reasons, and I thought you were going to say, well, you know, it costs so much, and you know, manufacturers are right that they need the money to invest in future. You know, I thought I was going to hear what we hear from a lot of the Republican lawmakers, that government shouldn't be involved in this and it interrupts the marketplace. But no, you said they're raising the prices because they can and they're competing with each other.
Yeah, I mean, the market is horribly distorted to begin with. It's not really a free market the way you think about, you know, going to the farmer's market and buying corn or something. These products are heavily regulated, and the FDA makes a determination about who can commercially sell insulin and who can't. And so to say that it's a free market and we shouldn't get involved is, we're way past that already.
Dr. Jing Luo, Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, on the cost of insulin and what can be done about that now that a universal cap is not in the bill just being pushed through Congress. Doctor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the UN's refugee agency says more than 6 million Ukrainians have fled Ukraine. The U.S. is welcoming up to 100,000 of them, and some of them are being resettled in places you might not expect. Eric Stone of member station KRBD has the story of four Ukrainian refugees who are now living and working on a retired state ferry in Ketchikan, Alaska.
Before Russia invaded Ukraine, 29-year-old Mikita Zakharchenko spent half a decade working on ships.
I worked in Europe. It's Mediterranean Sea, North Sea, England also. Yeah, we work in the big container ships.
Now he's spending his days on another ship, the MV Malaspina. It's an Alaska state ferry launched back in 1963. It used to take passengers in cars from Washington and Canada up the Inside Passage. But in 2019, the state took it out of service. It needed millions in steelwork if it was going to keep running. The ferry was sold and now has a new future docked in Ketchikan as a museum and maritime training center and as housing for dock workers. Zakharchenko and three other Ukrainian refugees are helping out with that transition.
Before, it looks like it's nobody live for 3 years here. It's not so bad, but we need to organize everything. It was dirty, too much dust, feel not so fresh air inside.
But now the lights are on, the water is running, and 16 people are living aboard, including the four refugees and a dozen employees of the ship terminal. By day, Zakharchenko works on restoring the boat. In the evenings, you're likely to find him at the Malaspina's bar, playing foosball, watching TV, or enjoying a home-cooked meal with the shipmates. Zakharchenko came to Ketchikan from the southern Ukrainian port city of Mariupol. He said the city had grown tense since Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. Then, this spring, tanks and troops started pouring over Ukraine's borders with Russia and Belarus. He knew it wouldn't be long before the fighting arrived at his doorstep.
It started from the 24th of February. We think it's full-out war, and we need to find some safe place.
He fled to the western part of the country and started volunteering. He stayed in Ukraine another 2 weeks before he says he was granted permission to leave for Germany in mid-March. Zakharchenko and his high school sweetheart and partner of 13 years made their way to Anchorage through the Uniting for Ukraine program. The federal program allows Ukrainian refugees to stay in America for up to 2 years if they have a sponsor. That's when longtime Alaska tourism businessman John Binkley says he got a call from someone helping them look for a home.
And we said, bring them to Ketchikan. We've got the perfect spot for them here. We'll take care of them. And we have the perfect situation, the MV Malaspina. That can take care of them as well.
They arrived in early June. Binkley says he's not paying the refugees. He says he's not allowed to until they're issued a social security number. But he's covering all their expenses. They have an account at the local supermarket, access to a car, and use of numerous toys at the cruise terminal, like kayaks, e-bikes, and sea cycles.
They've been phenomenal. People, just wonderful human beings, hardworking. They have purpose here now, and we've just come to love them and appreciate them, and we feel humbled to help in some small way.
16-year-old Sofia Zagrabelska is living aboard the Malaspina with her mother. It's the second time they've uprooted their lives fleeing the war. They lived near the eastern Ukrainian city of Donetsk until war broke out with Russian-backed separatists in 2014. They fled to Kharkiv. But then they were forced to relocate again this spring when Russian troops started bombing and shelling their new home. Zagrabelska says she's glad to be away from the fighting.
I'm very happy to be in USA because in USA I be in safe zone. I'm very happy I don't listen sound bomb. And I sleep in bed, not in how to say, underflow.
As for Mikita Zakharchenko, he says he could see himself staying here in Alaska for quite a while if the U.S. government allows it.
Oh, for 10 years, maybe, yeah?
Yeah.
I don't know. Everything is going good. I like this place. I like people who around me, who support me. I find new friends here. Also, my work is very interesting. I'm every day study something new.
He's glad to be safe, but at the same time, he yearns for home. He says he wishes he could turn back the clock to before the war and live his life in the country he loves.
I did not want to go away from Ukraine. It was my land, yeah. Everybody understands this, yeah.
But for now, a berth on the Malaspina will have to do. For Here and Now, I'm Eric Stone.
Well, this week marks the fifth anniversary of the white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. The deadly confrontation renewed a conversation there about the Civil War, memorials, and the legacy of Jim Crow. Last year, Charlottesville removed the statue of Robert E. Lee that was at the center of that rally. The city gave it to an organization that wanted to melt it down and recast it into something new.
What can we do in our community that would then take something that has been the source of trauma and reorganize it, reconstruct it, re-engage with it, and out of that process come to something that is that represents the social and cultural values of Charlottesville in its contemporary moment.
Here and Now, Scott Tong has been in Charlottesville, and that's one facet we'll explore in a series of reports tomorrow and Friday. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.